Hi there, and welcome to this first of five special Explaining History podcasts to celebrate the fact that yesterday we hit the 100,000 mark. So we now have over 100,000 subscribers on the Explaining History podcast. And this week we're going to be doing a giveaway, our first ever, which is terribly exciting. And we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of different stuff that's going to be useful, hopefully, for students and people that are just excited about history and the people that have really supported the podcast over the last few years. And while we're on that subject, I think there are a few people I really need to say thank you to dotted around the world who've come up with some great sources of support and inspiration. So in no particular order of importance and no particular order of preference, I'd just like to say a huge thank you to Michael O'Sullivan in Dublin, to Mehdi Arafa in Paris, to my good friend and benefactor Bill Gooden, to Lucy Benson for your endless support, to Meredith Jensen in California for your recent kind words, and to Dr. Alex Kay, who's written some brilliant stuff and has contributed to the Explaining History website in the past, and to all the good guys at IB Taurus, who have been a great publisher to work with, sent through some really interesting books. And there's never the expectation that we're going to have to descend into the grubbiness of the hard sell. So if I've missed anyone out, it's please don't hold it against me. I have a terrible memory, but I just want to say thank you to everybody for supporting the podcast till it's reached the monster that it is, and let it continue to grow. So today I'm going to talk about a very interesting set of processes that existed in the 1920s and 30s, really from the birth of the state of Poland at the end of the First World War through to its destruction in 1939. And these were related to the relationship between Poles, Jews, Polish nationalism, and Jewish Zionism, and how they had, in many ways, a strangely complementary relationship. And there was a degree of cooperation, of collaboration, and admiration on both sides. Yet, after 1935, this existed in a climate where the government of Poland was becoming progressively more anti-Semitic. The extent to which the Polish government and Polish society was becoming anti-Semitic was really nothing compared to what was happening in Germany. And yet, the logic of race relations in Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries would tend to suggest, and it is totally overturned in this case, would tend to suggest that if anti-Semitism had grown with force in anywhere, it should in theory have been in somewhere like Poland more so than Germany. Poland having between 2.5 and 3 million Jewish inhabitants, whereas Germany having really a couple of hundred thousand. And the fact that there is a far more complex relationship, I mean, there is anti-Semitism, both a grassroots and a state-led anti-Semitism in Poland, but there are also far more defenders of the Jews in Poland than are able to manifest themselves in Germany. So let's make a start. Let's talk about Joseph Pilsudski to begin with. Well, in fact, before we look at Pilsudski, we need to look at Jan Paderewski, the father of Polish independence, the talented concert pianist and composer, diplomat and a politician who represented Poland at the Paris Peace Conference and who had spent the year or so beforehand in America speaking with American Polish Jews and trying to bring the many millions of Jews who were within the current Russian Empire the parts of the Russian Empire that would comprise now a new Poland into a new Jewish state. Paderewski was no anti-Semite. He was a guy who understood that the Jews would have an important part to play in the state of Poland, and that Polishness was not necessarily an exclusively ethnic concept. But the opponent to this would, of course, be Roman Dmowski, who was the head of the Polish National Committee and was a strong anti-Semite and rival for Paderewski's position. The final nation-making moment for Poland came on the 27th of December 1918 in Poznan, where Paderewski encouraged Pilsudski to lead a national uprising to free Poland from the remnants of German control. Tsarist control in the east and German control in the west had both collapsed, and the opportunity now presented itself, as the war had ended, to create a Polish nation-state that would hopefully be ratified at the Paris Peace Conference. Dmowski was sidelined in this moment by Pilsudski, who was no anti-Semite at all. Pilsudski looks upon anti-Semitic politics with the same kind of bemusement and kind of mystification that he looked on Bolshevik politics. Pilsudski had existed within and grown up and lived within the confines of the Russian Empire all his life. He had been a liberal nationalist revolutionary, and had, as part of the revolutionary underground, the wider revolutionary underground within the Russian Empire, had rubbed shoulders with all manner of different revolutionary parties, including the Social Revolutionaries and, of course, the Bolsheviks. So he knew what Lenin was talking about. He knew precisely what Lenin intended to do. And he knew that Bolshevism represented a serious threat to the integrity of the new Polish state. The Polish state that Pilsudski had his eyes on was one which incorporated at least parts of Ukraine, and perhaps might even be a federation between Poland and Ukraine. This was a clear threat to the new Bolshevik state. So you have these essentially mutually antagonistic forces: a liberal nationalist Poland, let's face it, the liberal aspect of that doesn't really manifest itself too deeply with Pilsudski before we get too romantic about him, and a new Soviet state across the border. Both look upon the Ukraine as being their future. And finally, you have the pariah state of Germany from 1919 onwards, who has been penalised and punished in order that Poland might be allowed to live. Well, this is at least the way that German nationalists tend to see it. So, in essence, the fourth nation that exists within this milieu is the nation of the Jews of Poland. And as the new state of Poland emerged and developed, the relationship between the Poles and the Jews would develop and transition as well. And a strange romance develops between the most ardent Polish nationalists on the right and the extreme right-wing end of the Jewish Zionist movement, namely the revisionists, of whom Vladimir Jabotinsky and Menachem Begin are the most pivotal characters throughout this time period. Now, you may well have heard my previous podcast on Menachem Begin, and it's got a lot of stuff that pertains to this in it, so you might find that useful as well. So you can check it out. I probably did it a year, it seems like a year ago, it could be a whole bunch longer. Pilsudski had been popular with the Jews. He had had a very good relationship with them, and there were there's a large section of Jewish population that believed that Jewish people had a future in Poland. There were Zionists who argued that actually the Jews had found their Zion anyway, that it was alongside the Poles, and that together Poles and Jews would build the new Poland together, and that the ideas of finding a home in Palestine or somewhere else within the British Empire, that wasn't necessary. But after Pilsudski died in 1935, the new government that comes to power, the new National Unity Government, announced that it was going to insist on mass Jewish emigration from Poland. Now, before we start to make simplistic comparisons with between Poland and Nazi Germany in the 1930s, and say, they're all as bad as each other. Whilst forcing the Jews to leave Poland is indeed, you know, a kind of ethnic cleansing, and it certainly was nothing, it was not motivated by the same ideas that Hitler had in mind. It was motivated by different notions and gone about in a very different way. Hitler, I mean, if you read Black Earth by Timothy Snyder, it's a very, very good guide to some of these ideas. In it, he suggests that Hitler was essentially genocidal from the outset, from his earliest writings and thinkings, and that really the Holocaust is the meeting of ideas and circumstances. And and that Hitler believed that, you know, all was biological, only race and biology justify and dominate the world, nothing else. As the Poles don't think that, the Poles, the Polish anti-Semites who wanted the Jews to leave, argued that that Poland can't be a nation state with a foreign people in it, that you need to have one people in one place, and that also Poland's poverty could be alleviated by sending the Jews away, by reducing the growing population size and the pressure for land and all these things. Now, it's not to justify or to excuse Polish anti-Semitism over Nazi anti-Semitism, far from it. It's simply to distinguish between the two. Now, fortunately for the National Unity Government, the Poles had the National Unity Government had an ally in the revisionists. The revisionists agreed that the Jews of Poland didn't belong there, that they belonged somewhere else, and the other place, the place they agreed they belonged was Palestine. The Polish government had initially conducted a feasibility study into the question of deporting Jews to Madagascar. The French essentially objected to this, and they believed that Madagascar would become dominated either by Jews or Poles, neither of which, in the eyes of the French, was particularly an attractive thing. When Leon Blum, the Jewish Prime Minister of the National Government, came to power, the Poles were encouraged, and they thought that there might be some kind of arrangement that could be made with a Jewish leader, but they had no such luck. Initially, the Nazis were interested in the idea of shipping all of Europe's Jews to Palestine. Adolf Eichmann himself goes there in 1937 and realises it's a dead letter, that the British simply won't allow it. But there are significant forces within the Nazi party that say, well, we do not want a Jewish state emerging in the Middle East. Given the way we currently treat the Jews, and probably how we will be treating them in the future, this kind of revanchist state where the German people's deepest existential threat lies, that can, you know, spend a good amount of time arming and equipping itself, this would be a terrible idea. So it's the uprisings again by the Arab population within the Mandate of Palestine against the British that spell doom for any further plans to populate, to allow mass Jewish immigration into Palestine. And the pressure of Nazism on the World Zionist Movement makes itself apparent in 1935 when that movement splits. There are Zionists who advocate a gradual introduction of Jews into Palestine and an attempt, firstly, to try to build neighbourly relations with the Arabs before any further Jews come. But Jabotinsky in 1935 says simple mass immigration now. This is the only thing that will save us. And when we get there, what we do with the Arabs really is force them from their land and create this militant state of Israel. He believed that an Israel that spanned both sides of the River Jordan and perhaps that stretched down into the Sinai and had an outlet onto the Red Sea was the only viable state that could be created. So a very big state of Israel. Jabotinsky hoped that the Poles would gain the mandate of Palestine from Britain. A lot of this is kind of pipe dream stuff. But the British by the mid 1930s are quite fed up with Palestine. It's not worth really anything, and it causes an immense amount of trouble. It had been gifted to Britain, or Britain had wangled it at the Paris Peace Conference and now held it as a mandate. But there was every reason to imagine that the British might possibly want to dispose of it. The Poles and their Zionist Jewish collaborators were both versed in the art of creating nation states from within the confines of empires. Ultimately, this is how Poland had been reborn in 1918, and they knew the rule of Germanic, Austrian, or Russian empires very well. So they assumed that the British Empire would work in a similar way, and you could find ways of extracting concessions from it. The strength of revisionism was based mainly, however, in Poland itself, not in Palestine. There were obviously revisionist Zionists in Palestine at the time, but revisionist the kind of the legions really of a revisionist Zionism are in Poland in the guise of the Bitar Youth Movement. The Bitar Youth Movement was predominantly right-wing revisionist Zionist. They were well trained by the Polish army and were in effectively a kind of a fighting force. How effectively they ultimately fought is shown in the various disturbances and guerrilla warfare between the British and Jews in Palestine after the Second World War. One of the things that Timothy Snyder points out is Bitar were quite handy for the Polish government because they were extremely anti-communist, and the Polish government in the mid-1930s, with a dangerous Soviet neighbour to the east, had no truck with communist parties at all. So these guys were very useful. And the Bitar and Polish nationalist organisations would parade with each other's flags. Bitar often sang Polish patriotic songs. And there is this curious paradox of this a Zionist organisation, an organisation that wants to establish a home in Palestine, feeling proud and patriotically, if not Polish, then at least deeply affiliated to the Polish nation, seeing them as comrades in arms and brethren. And the Polish Secret Service and the Polish army gave Bitar and the revisionists an awful lot of help in establishing a military underground in the in Palestine, which sees the development eventually of the organization Irgun, the terrorist group that becomes chiefly associated with Menachem Begin. And Begin believes, and he was disputed really by Jabotinsky here, but Begin believed that a secret, hidden, conspiratorial, armed underground would be the way to found a Jewish state from the in Palestine against the British. Begin had learned much of what he knew within Poland and the Russian Empire from the terrorist underground of the Russian Revolutionary Movement. So I always find it fascinating when you see the journey of these ideas and principles and concepts throughout the century. And the what Begin was bringing to Palestine was essentially a Russian revolutionary terrorism. Irgun was connected to the Polish government. Witold Hulanicki, the Polish consul in Jerusalem, passed instructions back and forth from Poland to Irgun, and the way that it was viewed as in the highest echelons of the Polish government was that the Polish state had aspirations very, very similar, almost identical to those of the Zionists, and therefore it was important to see how the two could work together. The Poles, as we've already mentioned, after 1935, the Polish government was keen to see how Polish Jews could be removed en masse from Poland, and Palestine seemed to be the place to do it. And therefore, using Irgun as the leverage to bring about some kind of confrontation with the British, where hopefully the British would either abandon the mandate and then the floodgates would open, or the British would decide to relent and allow mass Jewish immigration because it was the path of least resistance. This was the strategy. I mean, neither side, of course, know that within 3 years' time Hitler will decisively intervene in Poland, and the Poles problems, the size of their population, will be dealt with in a whole horrific new manner. Because I suppose one way that you could interpret all this, if you're going to look at this from the from economic history, an economic history standpoint, the decision to go for whole-scale deportations of Jews from Poland in 1935, even if it has the cooperation of the most extreme elements of Zionism anyway, is in some ways explicable by the Great Depression. You know, you see this worldwide collapse in agricultural food prices and poverty coming particularly to the countryside over much of Europe and America, and the desire, therefore, to lower the population, to get rid of surplus population, you know, and therefore unemployment. And the surplus population you start with is your Jewish population. Now, it goes without saying that, of course, not all Poles signed up to this policy. And it was fiercely contested within Parliament, and fiercely contested particularly by the parties of the left, the Socialist and Communist parties, who were outraged and appalled that it was even being considered that the Poles should be shipped overseas. But this outrage didn't stop a gradual increase in anti-Semitic policies in the second half of the 1930s, such as banning kosher slaughter, and a decision by universities, social clubs and other institutions to discriminate against Jewish members. and to present Jews as the causes of communism, atheism, and all the other sins of modernity itself. So a lot of this was designed to kind of encourage the Jews to consider emigration to Palestine. But by 1939, there was still a large Jewish minority in Poland. And an indication that the Zionists, the revisionists particularly, were not as popular throughout the population, the Jewish population in Poland, as one might think, was the fact that the Bund Party, the original Jewish Socialist Party, the oldest Jewish Socialist Party, who were committed to staying in Poland and building a socialist society along with the Poles in Poland, did remarkably well in the 1938 elections. So the danger for historians is this, is that we know what happens next, and we know it's terrible. We know that in September 1939, that the Germans invade and inflict unimaginable cruelties on both Poles and Jews alike. And so we know that the world in which we're talking of Polish nationalists and of Zionists, that this was a kind of one with a limited time period. But we have to remember that they didn't know that. Now, this might seem obvious and rather trite to say, but it's very important not to get into this kind of teleological mindset where we start to think about ideas of inevitability or looking at the end point and trying to work backwards, because, you know, that's bad history. It doesn't work or help anybody. Okay, so I'm going to finish there. And just suffice to say, we're still running a crowdfunding campaign to make sure that we can continue to cover the hosting for Explaining History. So if you can make any donations at all, then I'll be hugely grateful. And the link is, as ever, comes with this podcast. Anyway, enjoy. Thanks very much. And thanks for all your support. All the best. Bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.